But let it also be granted that we turn people away from other physicians, the Stoics, who introduce a perishable God and say that his substance is a body wholly mutable, alterable, and changeable, and who at some point destroy all things and leave only God remaining. How would we not, in this way too, be freeing those who obey us from evils, and bringing them instead to the pious teaching about devoting oneself to the craftsman and marveling at the father of the Christian teaching, who has most benevolently, in a manner conducive to conversion, ordained teachings for souls to be sown throughout the whole human race? But even those afflicted with the folly concerning the transmigration of bodies, by physicians who drag the rational nature down, at one time into every irrational creature, and at another even into that which lacks imagination altogether, should we not heal them? How would we not thereby be making those persuaded by our reasoning better in their souls, a reasoning that does not teach that, as a portion of punishment, the wicked person is reduced to insensibility or irrationality, but rather shows that there are certain remedial medicines in the toils and punishments brought upon the wicked by God? For this is what Christians who live and think prudently administer to the simpler folk, just as fathers do to their quite infant children. For we do not, then, take refuge among infants and foolish rustics, saying to them, "Flee the physicians," nor do we say, "See that none of you ever lays hold of knowledge." Nor do we claim that knowledge is something evil, nor have we gone mad enough to say that knowledge leads people astray from health of soul. But neither would we ever say that anyone has been destroyed by wisdom, we who nor do you attend to me. Even if we teach, we say, no, attend to the God of the universe, and to Jesus the teacher of the lessons concerning him. None of us is so arrogant as to say to his acquaintances what Celsus has put into the mouth of the teacher, "I alone will save you." See, then, how much he falsely charges against us. But we do not even say that true physicians destroy those whom they profess to heal. And he brings forward a second example against us, claiming that our teacher does something similar, as if a drunken man, coming among drunkards, were to abuse the sober as though they were drunk. Let him show, then, from Paul's own writings, for instance, that Jesus' apostle was drunk and that his utterances lack the mark of a sober mind, or from what John wrote, that his thoughts do not breathe the spirit of one who is sober-minded and free from the drunkenness that comes of vice. No one, then, who is sober-minded and teaches the doctrine of the Christians is drunk. But Celsus says these things while abusing us in an unphilosophical manner. And whom do we, who advocate the teachings of the Christians, abuse as though they were sober? Let Celsus say, "For according to us all who speak to lifeless things as if to a god are drunk, and why do I say drunk? For they are rather mad, rushing to the temples and bowing down to statues or to animals as though they were gods. And no less mad than these are those who suppose that things constructed by vulgar and, at times, utterly base men have been made in honor of the true gods." After this, he likens the teacher to a man with diseased eyes, and the learners to those with diseased eyes as well, and he says that this man, among those with diseased eyes, accuses the sharp-sighted of being blind. Who then, shall we say, are the Greeks who among us do not see? Or those who, from the very greatness of the things in the world and the beauty of the works of creation, are unable to look up and perceive that it is fitting to worship and admire and revere only the one who has made these things? And none of the things constructed by men and taken up for the honor of the gods could rightly be worshipped, whether apart from the Creator God or together with him. For to compare things that admit no comparison at all with the Infinite One, who surpasses in surpassing excellence every created nature, is the work of a mind blind in its understanding. We do not, then, say that the sharp-sighted are the ones with diseased eyes or the blind, but rather those who, in ignorance of God, grovel before the temples and the statues and the so-called sacred festivals. These we declare to be blinded in mind. And this above all when, alongside their impiety, they also live in licentiousness, not even seeking out what deed is worthy of reverence, but doing everything worthy of shame. After this, having brought so many charges against us, he wishes to show that he has yet other things to say, but passes over them in silence. His words run thus: "These charges I bring, and others like them, that I may not enumerate them all, and I say that they do wrong in leading men astray concerning God, so that they entice wicked men with vain hopes and persuade them to despise better things, on the ground that it will be better for them if they abstain from them. But to this, it might also be said, on the basis of the actual conduct of those who come to Christianity, that they are not led astray as wicked men at all, the word as much as the simpler people, and, as most would call them, unrefined people do. For these, moved and driven by fear of the punishments that are announced, to abstain from the things for which the punishments exist, try to devote themselves to the piety of the Christian religion, so mastered by the word that, through fear of the eternal punishments named in accordance with the word, they come to despise every torment devised against them by human beings, and death together with countless pains, which no sensible person would say is the work of wicked purposes. For how could self-control and moderation, or the sharing and fellowship of goods, be practiced from a wicked purpose? Nor indeed is the fear of the divine, to which the word summons the many as useful, directed at those not yet able to see and choose what is choiceworthy for its own sake, and to choose it as the greatest good, surpassing every promise, from which it is not natural for such a thing to arise in one who chooses to live in wickedness. But if someone imagines that there is superstition rather than wickedness among the majority of those who believe the word, and blames our word for making people superstitious, we will say to him that, just as one of the lawgivers said to the person asking whether he had established the finest laws for the citizens, that he had established not the laws that were finest without qualification, but the finest of those they were capable of, so it might also be said on behalf of the Father of the Christian Word, that I established, for the improvement of character, the finest laws and teaching that the many were capable of, threatening not false punishments and torments for sinners, but ones that are true and necessary, brought to bear for the correction of those who resist, though not that they altogether understand the intention of the one who punishes and the purpose of the sufferings. For this too is spoken usefully, in accordance with the truth, and with a certain concealment for their benefit. Still, on the whole, those who profess Christianity are not led into wickedness. Nor indeed do we do violence to the divine, for we speak about it things that are both true and, while seeming clear to the many, are not clear to them as they are to the few who practice philosophy in accordance with the word. Since Celsus also says that those who become Christians are led on by empty hopes, we will say to him, who blames the teaching about the blessed life and about fellowship with the divine, that as far as you are concerned, sir, those who have accepted the teaching of Pythagoras and Plato about the soul are also led on by empty hopes. The soul being by nature able to rise up to heaven's vault, and, in the region above the heavens, to behold the sights beheld by the blessed spectators. But according to you, Celsus, those two who have accepted the soul's continuance, and who live so as to become heroes and to have their dwelling with the gods, are led on by empty hopes. And perhaps also those who have been persuaded about the mind, from outside, as immortal, and as destined to have an independent existence, would be said by Celsus to be led on by empty hopes. Let him then contend, no longer hiding his own sect, but confessing himself an Epicurean, against what is held among Greeks and barbarians, not things said contemptibly about the immortality of the soul, or its continued survival, or the immortality of the mind. And let him show that these are mere arguments deceiving those who assent to them with empty hopes, while the doctrines of his own philosophy are free of empty hopes and either lead to good hopes, or, which better fits his position, produce no hope at all, because of the soul's immediate and total dissolution. Unless, of course, Celsus and the Epicureans will refuse to call it an empty hope, the hope concerning the end that is their pleasure, which according to them is the good, the settled, stable condition of the flesh, and the confidence Epicurus places in that. Do not suppose that I have inappropriately brought in, against Celsus, on behalf of the Christian argument, those who have philosophized about the immortality or continued survival of the soul. Since we have certain things in common with them, we will show at a more fitting opportunity that the coming blessed life will belong only to those who have accepted the reverence for God that follows Jesus, together with a sincere and pure piety toward the Maker of all things, unmixed with anything created whatsoever. But let whoever wishes show what better things we are persuading people to despise. And let him set against it what belongs to us before God in Christ, that is, in the word and wisdom and every virtue, the blessed end that will befall those who have lived blamelessly and purely, and have taken up an undivided and unsplit love toward the God of all, and that will be met by a gift of God. Against the end, promised by every philosophical school among Greeks or barbarians, or by any mystery cult's promise. And let him show that the end according to some other school is better than ours, and that it follows as true, while ours is unsuited to what God gives as a gift, nor to those who have conducted their lives well, or that these things were not spoken by a divine spirit that filled the souls of pure prophets. And let whoever wishes show that human arguments, acknowledged as such by all, are better than the things demonstrated as divine and announced through inspiration. But of what better things do we teach those who accept them that they will be freed? For if it is not too offensive to say, it is self-evident that nothing can even be conceived as better than entrusting oneself to the God over all, and devoting oneself to a teaching that draws one away from everything created, while leading one, through a living and animate word, who is also living wisdom and Son of God, to the God over all. But since these remarks have taken on a sufficient scope, and the third volume of what has been dictated by us in reply to Celsus's treatise has thereby reached its natural limit, we will bring our discourse to a close at this point, and in what follows, we shall contend against what Celsus wrote after this.